Welcome back. Hey, this is the Bringing It All Back Home podcast. I'm your host, Charles. And yeah, nice to come back to the podcast. Kind of an early morning here. And a little bit of a deja vu as far as weather goes here in South Jersey. Part two this month of Canadian wildfire impact. Air quality today is only moderately hazardous as opposed to that first week in June where it was in the red. So I still think I'm going to try to just adapt today and do what I was planning on doing, which was taking advantage of what was supposed to be the first really nice clear weather in a while and do a long bike ride. I've actually got a camera for the bike ride as well. So not really long, but you know, going from the southern part of this island all the way up north and back, kind of a typical road trip, including the main street down here, Atlantic Avenue, and onto the infamous boardwalk that starts in Ventnor and hits Atlantic City. It's a trivia, the oldest boardwalk in the world. Anyhow, welcome back on board. Got a couple of different things today. Not really an overriding theme to today's podcast, but it's going to touch on lenses and filters and developers and maybe more. So, hope you'll enjoy it. And if you'd like, get a sip of your favorite beverage. And we'll jump right in. So where I'd like to start with is lenses. So in the last month or so, our favorite lensrentals.com has had one or two promotions. One was kind of weird. It was kind of like you had to do it in June, but it wouldn't be active until July. So that was the first one. I think that was like a 20% off. And as you guys may already know, I would highly recommend it. If you do plan on renting more than four or five pieces of gear from Lens Rentals, you might as well do this thing where they have free shipping for the whole year. Ends up costing $99. But if you don't do it, you get charged $25 every time you rent. So basically I did that, sometime in 2023. So I've got a full, I got a lot of months left to do as much renting as I can from Lens Rentals. I went ahead and got a rental of a lens. Not sure if I would ever buy. I'm kind of hoping I would get madly impressed with it. A little bit more expensive than I'd like. But this is another Voigtlander, the 50 millimeter. And I'll get more about 50s in just a little bit later on in this podcast. The 50 F2, so not crazy wide open, but still pretty fast lens. But this is the one that's trying to compete with a very, very expensive Leica version. This is the APO or APO -Lanther spherical. So yeah, this is basically Voigtlander's spherical lens. For Leica, I believe they also make this for other dedicated mounts. I know they make one for Sony as well. But yeah, this is the M mount. This is the Leica version. Really curious about this lens. Everything I read about it seems pretty awesome. So it's not a cheap lens, but compared to what it's trying to compete with, it is insanely cheap. So it's punching up against the Leica version, which I don't have the price at my fingertips right now, but let me just see. What is a Leica 50, a spherical? What is that sucker going for? The 50 spherical, the APO, I guess. Is that the, should I type that into? So here we go. B&H Leica 50 APO. There's the SL version. And here is, okay, yeah. So here is the Leica version. The Leica version of this lens is, drum roll please, $8,000. $5,000. And if you want it in silver, it's a little bit more. It's like $8,243. Not a cheap lens. So yeah, the Voigtlander version is, I believe, around $900 brand new, you know, give or take a little bit here and there. So yeah, it looks interesting. Not a really small lens. You know, what's one of the things I really love about my 35 Nocton, a nice small lens. It doesn't really protrude too much. But yeah, the whole 35, 50 thing, I'm going to possibly touch on that a little bit more toward the end of this episode today. But yeah, craving a 50. Don't have a 50 mm light right now. I had sold my original 50 M mount, which I bought with my M4 around the same time, the Zeiss. Sold the Zeiss, switched to the Voigtlander. Very happy with the Voigtlander 35. Have a series of pretty good shots. Not crazy expensive, really nice little lens. But I'm getting itchy for something different, and I'm really going through one of these phases where I'm kind of turned off by 35. I want to get back to just the pure 50 frame lines. More again about that. So I keep saying more again about that. Might as well just go into it. Anyhow, that's the first lens I'm renting. That's going to show up in another 2 or 3 weeks. That is my late July rental, I guess around July 20th. But then they had another promotion for 15% off. And I'm like, well, okay, maybe I'll just rent something really expensive for just 3 or 4 days. And that's what I did. So I did a 4-day rental with the 15% off and free shipping. And I jumped into the Sony version of the 51.2 autofocus lens. That one I'm really, really curious about. I've only used the 51.2 once before when I rented the Nikon Z version of it. Huge lens. This one is almost as big. I think it maybe weighs a little bit less, but yeah, you know, it's a gigantic lens for, of course, the mirrorless system. I've since sold off all my Nikon mirrorless stuff. I'm now on the Sony side of things with just one lens right at the moment. I've only bought a manual focus Zeiss 21mm. So I've got a landscape lens on it right now. And yeah, I had a podcast a while ago about, you know, like, do I even want to get a portrait lens for digital? Because I'm so in love with doing portraits with film, especially medium format, etc. But yeah, I'm still tempted about that. You know, I haven't really tested out the autofocus on my, I haven't at all. I've literally not put a single autofocus lens on my A7 R3, which I bought used off of eBay after I sold my Nikon C5. Haven't tried the autofocus. And I figured, what better chance to try the autofocus than messing around with a 1.2? So yeah, I have the 1.2. It's during part of the week where I'm really not on vacation in any way, which is always a weird thing to do. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, can I actually get anything decent for portraits during these days when I'm mostly going to be at work. Maybe I'll sway somebody at work to possibly help me out. I do have one of the days where I'm renting it where I'm off. So who knows? Yeah. So that's the first part of today's podcast, doing some lens rentals. If there's ever a time where I guess you may want to rent some stuff, you know, summer should be a good one, you know. At least if it's not apocalyptic air quality, you should find a sunny day or two, I would hope, wherever you guys are listening. So yeah, part one was about renting some lenses. They're not here yet. They will be here soon. Hopefully they will inspire a podcast episode or two as we approach July very quickly. The next thing I got, which I've never tried before. So yeah, I guess there's a theme going here. I've never tried the Sony 51.2. I've never tried the Voigtlander APO or APO. How do you pronounce that? APO. Two lenses I've never tried before. I have a new developer in my hands. I've never tried this either. So I somehow discovered an Ilford developer that I'm surprised I've never tried before. Ilford Perceptol. Love that name, Ilford Perceptol. Sounds almost like it's, I don't know, like it's, if it does it, does it help with your perception? Are there hallucinogenic properties to this Ilford Perceptol? A little bit of Perceptol microdosed every day. But yeah, this looks interesting. So according to Ilford, unlike just using their version of D76, their ID11, the Perceptol is especially geared towards slow films, and it helps with the extra fine grain and, of course, a little bit of sharpness. So they describe it as an extra fine grain powder developer. It supposedly has more image sharpness and detail. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And they just basically list their, you know, slower films. So they, of course, talk about their T-grain films like Delta 100. They mention the classic FP4+. And what I still have four rolls of, which is the Pan-F. So I figure this is perfect. You know, I'll use this developer on my last four rolls of Pan-F. See how it rocks. So I'm very much looking forward to this guy. I still have not committed to another bulk roll right now. What I do have is four rolls left of my last bulk roll, which was Pan F50. And maybe this developer will help sway my decision. I love the price point of the Pan F50. I love the fact it dries flat. Obviously, 50 is not the most flexible, you know, film speed. But I love the fact it is trying to do something specific. You know, it's trying to go for that vintage. Yeah, so I am looking forward to doing a test of Ilford Perceptol and seeing if it will sway me on my next bulk roll. And again, just to recap, I'm very happy with Pan F. Just deciding if I want to do another bulk roll to go going back to the T-grain stuff. You know, should I go to the tried and true T-Max 100? Not a cheap bulk roll at all, but an incredibly reliable, often, you know, mind-blowing film to use, especially when testing out new cameras. You know, you're basically like, if it doesn't look good on T-Max 100, then there's something not so great about that camera. There should be something of merit because it's such a spectacular film. On the other hand, you know, if you really want to be blown away by T-Max 100, shoot it on 6x7. You know, shoot it in medium format, nice and big. Your eyes will pop out at the resolution. On the other hand, you know, I figure let's change things up this summer. So instead of bulk rolling or bulk roll buying the T-Max 400, I've just purchased, you know, a number of rolls separately from B&H just to see if it can kind of kick me in gear. I'm very much liking T-Max 400. I'm not sure if I'm yet in love with it, but it's starting to grow on me. You know, I think it's a sort of a slow burn kind of film. So yeah, that's the second part of my episode today. I'm going to try out something new when it comes to developer, the Pan-F. So the third thing I want to talk about is this a combination of what I mentioned as I introduced the episode today. The not-so-hot phase I'm in right now when it comes to shooting with a 35mm prime. It's just a little bit weird how there will be times where I am absolutely in love with shooting with a 35mm prime. And in my case, it's paired with my 1969 M4, the silver chrome. To me, it just seemed like a much more interesting pairing. I was very happy with the Nocton lens. I'm very happy with that nice bright frame line that's almost completely filling the viewfinder at 35. Super easy to compose with as far as just, you know, the M4 is such a beautifully uncluttered viewfinder. But here's the but. So when I do succeed in finding a 35mm lens shot with my M4, when I do succeed in finding one that really works, that really, you know, like kind of, I always use a Leica shot that works, has some semblance of either a Magnum photo, pick your Magnum photographer, or even I sometimes go back to like a really early Annie Leibovitz stuff for Rolling Stone when she was still shooting black and white, you know, with a 35. Anyhow, when it works, it works. But when I look at the whole roll, whether it was 24 or 28 or the rare times I actually shoot a full 36, I see so many shots where the compositions just fall short. Where I like to use the expression, there's dead air in the composition, you know, where some part of the scene grabbed me, but I just don't have the talent yet to know how to fill the frame in a way that's truly meaningful when it comes to 35. So yeah, I often find when I look back at my M4 Nocton shots, those 35mm frame line shots, there's just a bunch where I'm like, you know, like it's this sort of deflating feeling, like the tightness of the composition has been punctured, and there's just this dead space in the composition. Like, what's that doing? You know, it's something's off. Something's not quite there. Now, on the other hand, before I jump into how great 50 is, I did notice one time I did go out for a walk where I literally had 35 on my shoulder. I had a 35mm lens, and I had a 50. And I was just shooting the same subjects in 35 and 50, and 35 and 50. And in that scenario, there were quite a few where I'm like, the 35s where I was able to get so much more of the shot that I wanted. Okay, but that's an exception. In general, I don't think I'm trained yet to be a 35mm lens shooter. Getting a lot more misses than hits. So part of me is like really craving the 50 again. I don't have a 50 that fits on my Leica right now. Don't have one. That's why I mentioned I'm renting a new one in July. What I do have, though, is the 40 Summicron C for the Leica CL, which you would think, well, why don't I just leave it on the CL with my 40 frame lines and just go out for a walk? And this is another one of those things. I was hot. I'm feeling a little bit cool right now when it comes to the to my lovely little Leica CL that I sent out to get repaired from Don Goldberg, the infamous DAG, because it went through all the typical wacko issues. But this most particularly, it went through the whole thing where the take-up spool, that little plasticky Minolta-ish white take-up spool bit where you line up the film header, or leader rather, that cracked, and one piece fell out, and then it cracked again, and two pieces fell out, and finally the whole thing just fell apart and disintegrated. And okay, so now what am I doing? I literally tried taping the film to the spool. I'm like, yeah, that's going to get old, and who knows where that's going to go. So sent it out to get CL-A'd from the Mr. Leica himself, I guess, Don, in the U.S., DAG, D-A-G, Don Goldberg. Or is it Dan? No, I think it's Don, right, Don Goldberg. It's back. And, it sounds tight. You know, the shutter just sounds fantastic. But the thing is, I feel like I've gotten spoiled by the M4 frame lines. Those frame lines are so sweet. Like, it's just either a nice little yellow border for your 50 or a wider yellow frame line when you throw a 35 on there. Whereas like the CL frame lines, the CL viewfinder is just so freaking cluttered. You know, it has that, like, it's showing you where the metering should be. It's showing you like where the 50 never goes away. So the 50's in there, 50 frame lines. And then the way it outlines the 40 is just so not consistent in the same way that the way the freaking M4, when you look through it, is just perfect when you look at the frame lines. Absolute perfection. There are white frame lines. Their border is easy to see. The CL frame lines are not doing it for me. Anyhow, long rant on the comparison of the frame line shizzle. So I don't have a 50. If you throw the 40mm lens, the Summicron C, on an M4, as opposed to an M6, as opposed to an M3, They're all slightly different, but basically on the M4, it will bring up the 50 millimeter frame lines. Only, of course, your composition is going to not quite be the same. When you get it back, it's going to take in a little more of the frame, depending if the object was right in front of you at, say, 2 or 3 feet, or whether you were shooting at an infinity. Huh. Anyhow, I went out for a walk with my M4 using the Summicron 40, and I loved it. It was absolutely great. And, you know, I think there was maybe one photo out of all of them that I just cropped a little bit. I'm like, I want to take it back to as close as possible of what I was seeing through the viewfinder. And the rest I just left alone. I think that knowing where my 50 is and composing by that, it's not such a big deal when I get back from after developing to discover I've got a little bit extra in the shot. But yeah, really, really enjoying the 50 frame lines again. Really, really enjoying going back to 50. It makes me wonder if I'll ever, you know, leave what I think is the heart of my compositional meager talents. You know, is at least so far, I find just 50 so much easier to work with. Am I being forced to step back? Yes, quite a lot. I'll go in and go, nope, I got to step back. But on the other hand, I just feel like, yeah, but once I can kind of find my diagonals and my thirds and where I'm anticipating the magic to happen a lot faster with that tighter frame line. Yeah. So that's it. Basically, I shot a roll using the Leica lens on the M4, even though it's a slight mismatch, and I was absolutely loving it. So two more things I want to bring up on the podcast. As I went off on my last episode, absolutely loving the incredibly under-the-radar zoom lens from the modern era of the Nikon film cameras. You know, so if you're not sure what I'm talking about, take a look at the previous episode. And what I could not resist was just completing the whole picture. So when I was testing out that lens and being blown away by the quality, I was using it on my Nikon F100. But I figured, well, hey, might as well get the lens this thing originally appeared with. I'm sorry, get the body that this lens originally appeared with. So I went out and found a matching colored Nikon N65. Got an N65, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. My bad. Let me try that one more time. Not a 65. I was originally looking for the N65. I got the more recent one, the N75. So, yeah. Both are, I think, practically the same camera. I forget what the exact slight difference is. But, yeah, I got the Nikon N75. And I have not shot much with it yet. That's why I'm going to, as soon as this podcast is over, I'm going to go out on a bike ride and finish up one, if not two rolls. I'll see what happens. Part of me is thinking I may need a second roll if I stop back to where a skate park in Atlantic City has had an upgrade of sorts. And yeah, kind of looking forward to it. In fact, I'll leave a link about this camera. I just found a nice article. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Mr. Tom Hogan. Tom Hogan, T-H-O-M, and his last name is Hogan, H-O-G-A-N. He's got an amazing assortment of rich, well-designed websites with so many interesting reviews. He's been around quite a ways. This is the, a lot of the technology of a Nikon F5, you know, in a body that's all consumer, you know, so it's all plastic, but it has the matrix metering, has the autofocus capabilities, the build quality, yeah, it does feel cheap. The flash sync is relatively not so great. you cannot use manual lenses on it, or if you do, it's going to be clunky as heck. Can't meter with them. But yeah, according to Tom, all the issues that had been on the N65 had been fixed, and he thought it was an incredible bang for the buck. And the feature specifications are what he calls rich and deep. So yeah, I basically threw it on aperture priority. I was out this morning shooting at F8. Mostly it seemed to just grab, 1/500. But I'm loving how light it is. Incredibly, incredibly light lens. Light body. So this guy is literally 380 grams. 13-ounce camera. The seller threw a brand new Nikon neck strap on there, which I love because it's a completely mismatch. He threw a brand new Nikon D750 strap, and I kind of love that. That's one of my things lately is to have camera straps that don't match the camera, but it's brand new. So basically, I got a brand new camera strap and what appears to be a brand new condition 2002 era. I'm trying to find if I can get a date on this guy. I don't quite see the date. Let's see if I can find it one more time. N75, here we go. So this is the wiki page. And 2003. Yeah, and as wiki puts it, it's basically a version of the Nikon F5 in plastic. All right, yeah, so that's another one. I'll have the results relatively soon, maybe even by the next episode. I'll tell you more about how that guy performs. So to wrap up today, I have one more thing I'm going to talk about. I went on a little bit of an unexpected ND filter craze. Where did this came from? I have no idea. Sometimes you just got to let things happen. How about you guys? Have you guys gone through a ND filter phase or two or three or four? Mine goes way back. My ND filter thing was when I was first really discovering digital photography with my Nikon D200, and then of course still passionately into ND filters with my D300. I had my heavy duty slick aluminum tripod that weighed a ton. And yeah, I would throw that sucker underneath the piers here on a crappy weather. It was perfect for the crappier the weather, the lovelier. I would often use the ND filter stuff on the beaches here. So I found my go-to was when the waves are kicking up and the wind's kicking up and the skies are ugly, I would just park my camera underneath the pier, go as wide as I could on my kit lens back then, and which I guess was equivalent to a 28, stack some freaking filters on there. I would stack like a six stop and maybe a three stop, or I forget, or maybe I had a 10 stop and a three stop. Either way, I would experiment with stacking filters, and then I would always convert this stuff to black and white. And that was too when I was extremely passionate about the Nick Silver effects. You guys remember that program? I still have it, but I'm not quite as in love with it as I used to be. But yeah, that was a thing. And again, back then, all these filters were like screw-on Hoyas. I think one was like an ND400 for the 67mm thread, which again was on my kit lens. Fast forward quite a bit, at least 10 years I'm talking about now, 2023. As I mentioned, I have what I consider essentially a landscape lens, a 21mm Zeiss on my digital camera for shooting landscapes, the relatively high megapixel A7R III. And I have not yet really done any long exposures, on it. So on this incredibly terrible weather solstice day we had last week or so, I guess what was that? The 21st. The weather was extraordinarily bad down here. Really, like winds that began crappy and got even worse during the day. I basically went out with my heavier tripod, and I had an adapter. I had a little step up because the thread on my Zeiss, I think, is 52. So I had a little step-up adapter from 52 to 67, and I think I was using a breakthrough. So I had a breakthrough ND filter, which was only six stops. And as crappy as the weather was, it was still way too bright when I was doing this. So I did not succeed in getting very much of a long exposure. I did manage to get quite a little bit of sand in my eyes, and I ran off the beach as quick as I could because it was like a pissing kind of rain slanted with like gusts of wind anywhere from 20 to 40 mile an hour. It was such a shit day for the first day of summer. Anyhow, but it got me thinking, like, well, you know, maybe I should just look around, try some different kind of glass. So I found, just for kicks on Amazon, this 10-stop ND filter with a 52 millimeter thread, direct from China, of course, called Green.L. And they have a website called greenlfilter.com. So yeah, this was a 10-stop ND filter. This guy was absurdly cheap. I think I paid like, I don't know, what did I pay? Like $20 or less for this ND filter. Take a look here. Yeah. Okay, maybe this was a, okay, no, that's another one. Yeah, this was $17.99. So yeah, I figured, well, this will be a fun experiment. How much can you get of a $17.99 10-stop filter? Who knows? And then, just to wrap up, I was looking at Twitter, looking at my feed, and one of my favorite people I follow on Twitter, which I think I may have recommended a shout-out before, it is Aid Taylor, this fantastic, mostly film photographer, but not exclusively, who's, as he puts it in his bio on his filter page, usually found up a Derbyshire hill or scurrying around in woodlands with a camera. And a warning, some tweets may contain images of dry stone walls. Anyhow, if you're a gear fanatic, follow Aid Taylor. His is at 6x6, but there's like an underscore underline thingy. So it's like 6_by_6. Anyhow, Aid was showing off a filter on his Leica digital camera. So he's got one of those SL2s, I guess. Anyhow, I've never heard of the name of this filter manufacturer. They're called Earth. That's so funny. That sounded like I just said the planet Earth. An old buddy of mine, Anthony, for whatever reason, would sometimes, he would say Earth, but it sounded like he was saying Earth. Anyhow, this is Earth, but it is URTH. So planet URTH, planet Earth. Anyhow, this is a filter, also 10 stops, a little more expensive, but supposedly incredibly good value. So I want to just see, is this one better than a breakthrough? Because I was kind of sold on the hype and the marketing of breakthrough. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about, breakthrough filters. They've been out for over 10 years, and they were basically really, really competing with, what are they, the BW filters and the Hoya stuff and the Lees and the all the expensive filters. They were a company out of San Francisco, obviously making these filters in China, but supposedly using better glass, blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, these guys also, of course, are made in China, but they are designed, I guess, in the U.S., and they're called URTH. So I decided to order the 52-millimeter, 10-stop filter, and I will hopefully have a chance to test that out. I'm going to compare that. Maybe I should just do a three comparison. Compare the breakthrough. Compare the... And the breakthroughs are not cheap. Like, the breakthroughs are easily starting at around $120 for a 10-stop. But yeah, compare this guy. Supposedly, the vignetting's controlled. Both these things, both the examples, both the super cheap Chinese one, the Green L, and even this Earth, they seem like they do tend to have a warmer color cast, even though they say there's none. I don't care, because with the exception of sunsets by the pier, most of the stuff I want to do during the daytime under the piers here and just convert it to black and white. So I'm not too worried about color. So yeah, that is a wrap for today. It looks like I will have quite a few things to talk about on the upcoming episodes. Hopefully this may have inspired you guys to take a look at some new ND filters, or maybe again consider the plastic wonder that is the Nikon N75 coupled with the Miracle lens. Again, that's the 28-80G autofocus. Whether or not you're with me on the 50 versus 35, yeah, even I can't figure it out. I think it is just something I go through where I'm hot and cold on 35 frame lens. But right now, yeah, I'm tending way more to get back to just the 50. I'm really excited to see if I can notice some development difference with the Ilford Perceptol. Really looking forward to that. And yeah, hopefully, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure what to expect with that Voigtlander lens, you know, the poor man's APO or APO. I'm kind of curious. I've never had a spherical quality lens, you know, see what kind of hype this lives up to. But yeah, very curious to see on the developments on these. So anyhow, this is Charles. Thanks one more time. Thanks again for tuning in to bring it all back home. And you can join in on the conversation if you want. Let me know. Reach out to me on social media if you'd like to have a live chat, or if you just have any questions about where to go as we pretty much getting close to wrapping up season 3. I got a feeling this will wrap up in a couple more episodes, take a little break, and come back for the fall. Anyhow, thanks again for listening. See you next time.